Members, we're going to get started. We do not yet have a quorum, so we can't call the meeting to order just yet, but I would like to give Representative Norton a opportunity to present her bill in entirety. There are some handouts coming around. As we get to a quorum, we'll approve the minutes and officially bring the meeting to order and take action on your bill, Representative Norton. We can't move it yet without the quorum, but welcome to the committee. Just for committee members, a little path we're going on today is we will hear Representative Norton's bill, and then we will be hearing from NAMI. And they have a full presentation. What we're going to do is let them all present and testify, and then we're going to open it up to questions. That way they can get their presentation done in an orderly fashion, and then all of them will stick around and be available for questions afterwards. So appreciate all of you being here, and we look forward to hearing from you. Representative Norton, why don't you begin with the presentation of your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And I'm going to quickly kind of give an overview of the bill, and I'm going to give an abbreviated version because we have a number of people who are here to testify both for and against the bill, and I want to give them an opportunity. And frankly, if you have a lot of detailed questions, they'd be better off answering them than perhaps I would. But I will give you an overview just to kick off the bill. And when you're ready to move the bill, Mr. Chair, you can just interrupt me and when you get a quorum. I'm really happy to bring this bill forward. I've been hoping to get a committee hearing for several years now, and we haven't been able to do that. And so this is the first opportunity that this bill has had to be heard in the House for some time, and it's the Nurse Licensing Compact Bill. This bill has already been adopted in 24 states, and I believe it will help bring Minnesota a step closer to the future in healthcare, which is one that uses more technology, one that uses the medical home model, and has excellent case management. And I think this bill will help take medicine beyond the doors of the hospital out into where the patient lives as they leave the facility and they go back to their home or home state, as the case may be. They will be able to have nursing care follow them. This bill provides then a continuity of care that quality providers want to give to their patients in their facilities, but again, after they leave. Whether it be snowbirds that we certainly have in Minnesota that are here for the nice weather and fly south for the winters, but want to maintain their association and relationship with their Minnesota provider, or whether it be folks that come to the state of Minnesota to provide to get care at a burn center or perhaps Mayo Clinic or some of the other larger facilities that have specialty care, but then need to go home when the immediate care is over, then they need still to be taken care of by perhaps a follow-up call from a nurse. This will allow those that type of follow-up to occur. The compact isn't simply then about bringing nurses into the state, but because that option already exists. We have a border state agreement that was passed back in 2002, and that allows nurses in bordering states to come over into the state of Minnesota. But something I didn't understand until I had taken up this bill is that doesn't allow nurses in Minnesota then to have the same reciprocity in the states that we border. And so this bill, all the states surrounding Minnesota, as well as I said, 24 states total that belong to the compact, will allow our nurses in Minnesota to be able to practice outside our state without having to buy licenses in each of those states. And I can tell you from many of you probably have gotten some emails, one of them was a nurse that has license in 11 states and is seeking to get four more in order to do her business. And it's costly not only for the individual, but perhaps for the organization that they work for, whether it be a hospital or other provider. So one of the concerns I've had raised, I just want to talk about right now, is that this isn't a bill that's trying to interfere with unions or bargaining. This bill and the compact won't interfere with that. In fact, right now, nurses can come into the state of Minnesota and get a license within 48 hours. We saw that happen just recently under our current laws. So this will not affect that, and the fair share rules still exist that are in the state of Minnesota. So several points I just want you to be aware of before I bring our testifiers up is that all licensed nurses in the United States pass the same exam, and they have to graduate from an approved program to do so and become a nurse. All nurses practicing in Minnesota are that would come here under the compact or otherwise have to follow the rules that this legislature sets in the state of Minnesota for nursing practice. So nurses that would come in under the compact or bordering state rules or any other still have to follow the rules Minnesota has in statute. You ready?
Representative Norton, we now have a quorum, right. And so I will call the meeting to order officially. I'll entertain a motion on the minutes from March 8th. Representative Benson moves the minutes from March 8th. He's reviewed them carefully. Any discussion to the minutes? Any changes? Seeing no indication, we'll take a vote on the minutes. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Easy for you to say. Not easy for me today. All those against, and the minutes are approved. And I will also, I'll move on behalf of Representative Norton, House File 462 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. And we are back to your presentation, Representative Norton. Thank you.
You bet. Thank you very much. A couple other points I wanted to make is currently the Veterans Administration and other federal institutions, such as the federal prison system. In my community, we have the Federal Medical Center. Currently just require a license. It can be in any state and not necessarily for the one that the staff member is working in. While different states have slightly different requirements, such as those for continuing education, the hiring institution may set requirements as a condition of employment if they see fit. So if continuing education is a concern for the employee and they might worry that not everyone has had enough continuing education, they could require that as the hiring body. Patient safety is improved under the nurses' compact, as the nurse system would allow any complaints or violations to be filed in a single point of entry so that anyone could go to the nurse system and find out if violations have been filed rather than having to search through individual states. And we have others that will address the specifics. The Board of Nursing, who does support this, is here today, and they will be happy to answer specific questions you might have about patient safety. Finally, there are 110,000 nurses in the state of Minnesota at last count, and I haven't been contacted by all of them, and I hope you haven't either, but a substantial number have contacted me in support, in particular students who are going through their training right now and really want this option available to them. And while you are going to hear from some opponents, the Minnesota Nurses Association and the 20,000 nurses they represent do have some concerns, my hope is that the testifiers today will be able to address those concerns in order to waylay any fears or additional questions you may have so that we can move forward and make Minnesota the 25th state to have participation in the nurse licensing compact. So with that, I really would like you to hear from the testifiers who are experts in the field, and there are a number of them. And so
members, for those who were not here when we started this presentation, we are going to hear from all the testifiers first and then take questions, just out of respect to the presenter has requested that approach, and I think that that will move things along well. So we're not trying to cut off any debate, but out of respect to the presenter.
Thank you, Mr.
Welcome
Chair.
To the committee. Please
Thank
state you, your Mr. name Chair. For the record.
My name is Shirley Brecken, and I'm the Executive Director for the Board of Nursing. I'm going to address the regulatory aspect in terms of the Nurse Licensure Compact. As you know, the Board of Nursing is the government agency charged with regulating the practice of nursing in Minnesota. The nurse licensure system that we use today is over 100 years old. However, the way we deliver nursing care today is very different from what it was 100 years ago. This committee has been named the Health and Human Services Reform Committee. Adopting the Nurse Licensure Compact is the kind of reform that is needed for how we license nurses and regulate nursing practice today and in the future. The board's purpose in regulating nursing practice is public protection. Its mandate is to assure the public that individuals who practice nursing have the necessary education and competency to do so and that they're authorized to practice. The Nurses Union has expressed concern for how the compact would affect the board's duty to protect the public. I'm here to assure you that the 16 members of the Board of Nursing take that mandate very seriously. The Nurses Union says that nurses from other states are not held to the same licensure requirements as Minnesota nurses, but all states, as Representative Norton said, require a nurse to graduate from an approved school, and all nurses take the same national nurse licensure examination. The union also states that some states don't require continuing education. That is true. However, under the current border state recognition law, we allow nurses from Wisconsin and from North Dakota to practice in Minnesota on their state license, and those states don't have mandatory continuing education. The nurses' union says the board, under the compact, will not know who is practicing in Minnesota. We don't now. What we do know is who has a license to practice nursing, because all 24 states which are in the compact are required to report licensure data to NURSIS, a National Nurse Licensure Database. We know who has a license to practice in any compact state, if that license is valid, and whether it's been disciplined in any way. Employers are the ones who know who is practicing. They are obligated to assure that the license is valid and unencumbered. That collective national data bank provides even greater information to employers regarding nurses' authority to practice. Again, the nurses' union asserts under the compact that bad nurses can jump from state to state. Unfortunately, that also happens today under the current system. The vast majority of nurses work very hard to provide safe, competent, and compassionate care to their patients. However, as in any profession, there are individuals who are determined to be unsafe, practitioners, and game the system for their own interests. The states in the Nurse Licensure Compact recognize this very small number of nurses who seek the geographic cure and have sought to strengthen enforcement activities. All compact states must provide their licensure and disciplinary data to the national database. When it was found that some states were not doing this, there were significant efforts to improve this, and literally thousands of reports have been submitted since that was recognized. That's the purpose of audits and investigations, to find the problem and to correct it. The nurses database provides for the exchange of significant investigative data. That means if a nurse is practicing on a multi-state license, has a complaint filed in another state, all the states in the compact have access to that investigative information if there is risk of harm to the public. Currently, we have to wait until a state takes action to know there is a concern. Under the compact, we will know much sooner and public protection will be greater. Under the compact, if a nurse's license is disciplined in any way, the nurse's practice is limited to the home state. He or she cannot go to another compact state to practice. And if the license is suspended or revoked, all privileges to practice in all the remote states are similarly revoked, automatically eliminating the need to take disciplinary action in the other 23 member states. The nurses' union alleges the compact will cause problems for patients to file a complaint about a nurse for incompetent nursing care. Actually, patients can expect stronger enforcement under the compact. Complaints are filed with the Board of Nursing where the violation occurs. And because the states are able to share investigative data, the states cooperate on that investigation. Again, a state doesn't have to wait for another state to take action before proceeding with their own action. The final area I want to address is the allegation by the nurses' union that the states will lose the ability to adopt new requirements for nursing. The fact is, the legislature sets licensure requirements and will continue to have this authority under the compact. Ideally, the requirements would be the same from state to state. All boards of nursing currently, through the National Council of State Boards of Nursing, are working towards standardization of licensure requirements. To that end, the Minnesota Board of Nursing is actually seeking authority to do criminal background checks on applicants for licensure, something over 30 other states currently do. In closing, licensure requirements for competence are the same: graduation from an approved school of nursing and passing the same national licensing exam. Employers will have greater access to information regarding a nurse's authority to practice under the compact. Boards of nursing who have enacted the compact are able to act more quickly and efficiently through shared investigations and similarly taking action. Patients who file a complaint can expect better enforcement because of that. Enactment of this bill reforms nursing regulation. It reforms nursing regulation for how nursing care is delivered today and in the future. Rather than decrease public protection, the compact empowers the board to do a better job of public protection. thank you for your attention, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have.
Thank you. Members, especially those who just arrived recently, we are going to go through all the testifiers first and then open it up for questions. So if we could have our next testifier. Joe McLaughlin is on the list next. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Okay. I'm Joe McLaughlin, and I'm the Director of Nursing for Health Partners. Health Partners is a nonprofit healthcare organization providing healthcare services, health plan financing and administration, research, and medical education. Our mission is to improve the health of our members, our patients, and the community. Health Partners sites are located in the Twin Cities, St. Cloud, Duluth, and Western Wisconsin. As healthcare workers, our focus is on what is best and safe for our patients. As the only Level 1 adult and pediatric trauma center hospital in the East Metro, Regents Hospital serves patients from adjacent states, especially many patients from Western Wisconsin. Regents is a regional burn center. Therefore, we also receive patients from North Dakota, South Dakota, and Iowa. Burn and trauma patients generally do not choose where they go to receive their emergency care. They are brought to Regents because we provide the service that can save their lives. Their care does not end when they leave the hospital, as they rely on us for follow-up, regardless of where they live. As a standard of care, we contact our patients after discharge from the hospital to ensure an understanding of home care instructions, ensure follow-up appointments have been scheduled, and provide support to patients and families. Post-discharge follow-up calls are made to every patient to ensure continuity of care after discharge and to prevent hospital readmissions. This is a best practice and standard of care. Continuity and completeness of care is as important for clinic patients as it is for patients discharged from the hospital. Patients expect to be able to call to speak to their doctor or their doctor's nurse or email them in a message. We are unable to determine which nurse might receive or make a call asking for care from one of our out-of-state patients. Patients expect nurses to help them in managing and coordinating their care, no matter where they are physically. This is especially important in these tough economic times. All of our clinics have cared for patients who reside in Wisconsin. Licensure in multiple states is very expensive. Requiring multiple licensures for all of Health Partners nurses does not support our goal of lowering overall health care costs while providing best care, best experience. The Multi-State Nursing Licensure Compact Bill is an effort to protect the public and minimize unnecessary barriers to access safe and convenient nursing care. To sum up my testimony, I would like you to take away the following compelling reasons to support this bill. This bill will increase access to equitable care, improve patient safety, reduce health care costs, and increase patient satisfaction. The last but not least important reason is that surrounding states, including Wisconsin, Iowa, North Dakota, South Dakota, and Nebraska are already members of the compact. In these times, when we're partnering together with our neighbors for better solutions to lower cost, we must look to new strategies. Health Partners strongly advocates Minnesota's joining the Nurse Compact for the benefit of our neighbors, patients, family members, and friends that receive care in Minnesota but may live in a neighboring state. Based on this information, I encourage you to consider the passage of this bill to ensure the continuity of care for all of the patients that we serve. I thank you for your time, and I'd be pleased to answer any questions.
Okay, thank you, Ms. McLaughlin. I would ask testifiers, I think we're trying to keep this to 2 minutes per testifier just to stay on time. Appreciate that. I understand you'll be available for questions once we're done with the testimony. Our next testifier is Deb Hogginson. And perhaps the next testifiers could perhaps come down closer and we can just kind of move a little more expeditiously. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you. My name is Deb Hogginson.
And Ms. Hogginson, you're representing?
I'm representing myself. I'm an RN, and I am also currently a member of the Minnesota Board of Nursing, but my testimony represents my own opinion.
Very good. Please proceed.
My current practice is in nursing administration. I'm the Vice President of Patient Care and Chief Nursing Officer at St. Joseph's Area Health Services in Park Rapids, a critical access hospital in northwestern Minnesota. St. Joseph's is part of Catholic Health Initiatives, an organization that has facilities in 19 states. 10 of those states with CHI facilities participate in the Nurse Licensure Compact. Feedback from my CHI CNO colleagues in compact states finds that the compact increases access to nurses, facilitating and expediting the hiring process. Those that employ nurses with multi-state licensure privilege have not experienced patient safety or nursing practice issues with those nurses. It's been a support to recruitment, especially in rural areas, and is broadly seen as a valuable tool to mobilize nurses quickly when faced with a crisis or disaster. Prior to my role in Park Rapids, I worked for over 20 years for Maricare Health System, which is now part of Sanford. At the time, Maricare had locations in both North Dakota and Minnesota. I and many of my Maricare colleagues managed clinical services that had nurses working in both North Dakota and Minnesota. Patients and nurses moved between the two states to receive care and provide health care. Having the Nurse Licensure Compact in Minnesota would have made managing patient needs easier because it would have allowed more timely flexibility in providing nursing care where patients were located. We had to meet that obstacle by requiring nurses to be licensed in both North Dakota and Minnesota. This was an extra financial and operational burden to maintain multiple licenses. During that time, Minnesota enacted the Minnesota Border States Recognition Law. This allowed North Dakota nurses to be recognized in Minnesota. However, Minnesota nurses were still burdened with needing both a Minnesota and North Dakota license if their practice required providing care in both states. Even now, practicing in Park Rapids, which is not a border community, we face issues of practicing nursing across state lines because nurses provide health care counseling and support via telenursing or post-discharge follow-up over the phone to patients in other states. Park Rapids is a resort community. Patients who receive care in our community and need follow-up are often from other locations. The Nurse Licensure Compact would clarify the authority to practice for many nurses whose practice includes telenursing and give nurses the opportunity to provide continuing care to patients that reside in another state. I appreciate and respect the concerns brought forward by those that are opposed to this legislation. However, the impact of the Nurse Licensure Compact has been evaluated in 2003 by the National Council of State Boards of Nursing and in 2006 by the Gallup Organization. The Gallup Organization found that 88% of nurses in non-compact states favored being a member of the Nurse Licensure Compact. Further, there is no significant evidence to suggest that the compact has negatively impacted nursing practice or patient safety or the ability for nurses to resolve labor issues in states where it has successfully been implemented. Thank you for your consideration of this legislation.
Great. Thank you, Ms. Hogginson. Our next testifier is Sharon Prinson and Karen Brill, if you could also come up. Ms. Prinson, welcome to the committee. Please state your name and your the organization you represent for the record, and then proceed with your testimony.
My name is Sharon Prinson, and I'm a registered nurse and a nurse administrator for Mayo Clinic. And I'm speaking on behalf of Mayo Clinic and its affiliated clinics and hospitals in support of this bill. I've been a registered nurse for 24 years and have worked in the roles of staff nurse, nurse educator, nurse manager, and nurse administrator. As an organization, Mayo Clinic and Mayo Clinic Health System represents 10 hospitals with hospital bed sizes ranging from 18 beds to 1,157 beds. Mayo Clinic and Mayo Clinic Health Systems values nurses and believes nurses are a key contributor to high-quality, safe patient care. I am here to share that we support this bill as we believe that it will help promote public protection and improve access to qualified professional nurses. The reasons that we are supporting this will be made in 3 points. Point number one, benefits of one licensure. Mayo Clinic has operations in multiple states, many of which are members of the NLC. Adoption of the NLC in Minnesota provides our nurses with the opportunity to provide their expertise in skilled nursing to our patients throughout the country more efficiently. We are all working to provide our patients with the best care possible. As technology and healthcare models with the reform bill, such as the medical home area, move forward, this bill will help to clarify around newer mediums for providing care, such as telenursing or nurse helplines. We recognize that we will not be treating our patients the same in the future as we are today, and we need to be prepared to meet the needs of the patients and evolve to accommodate new models of care. The NLC breaks down state boundaries that are not relevant to providing patient care that is high in quality and safety. Point number two, benefits to our patients. NLC gives state authority, gives states additional authority in the areas of granting practice privileges, taking action, and sharing information with other NLC states. This is done via the Coordinated Licensure Information System, which is a national database that facilitates sharing of the licensure, investigative, and disciplinary information. As nurses, we are accountable for complying with the nursing practice laws and other regulations in the state where the patient is located at the time care is provided. This is similar to the driver's license compact and the need to obey laws in the states in which one is driving in. Enhanced sharing of licensure information between states is a good thing for patient care. Enactment of the NLC does not change the state's Nurse Practice Act in any way. Under the NLC, states continue to have complete authority in determining licensure requirements and disciplinary action on the nurse's license per the state's Nurse Practice Act. Point number three, national entry level standards. The NLC does not change our national standard of entry into the professional practice of nursing. To ensure public protection, nursing candidates for licensure are required to pass an exam. This exam measures the competencies needed to perform safely and effectively as a newly licensed entry-level nurse. The National Council Licensure Examination, or NCLEX, is the standard framework for both the registered nurses and the licensed practical nurses. In closing, Mayo Clinic believes that the NLC will help us best serve the needs of our patients while maintaining patient safety. Thank you for your time and your consideration of this bill.
Thank you, Ms. Princeton. Ms. Brill, welcome to the committee. Please state your name and the organization you represent for the record, and then proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Karen Brill. I've been a registered nurse for 24 years, and I serve as the Vice President of Patient Services at Gillette Children's Specialty Healthcare in St. Paul. I'm here today to speak on behalf of my organization and also on behalf of the patients that we serve. Gillette Children's provides specialty healthcare services to children and young adults with disabilities. We're proud to be recognized as a magnet organization in nursing excellence. In 2010, we delivered care to over 2,200 inpatients, performed over 3,400 surgical procedures, and coordinated over 132,000 outpatient visits. We also provided telehealth nursing services to patients and received over 39,000 calls last year from our patients and families. Gillette patients come to us from every county across Minnesota, from 42 of the 50 states, and from 13 foreign countries. I appreciate the opportunity to testify on this issue that affects nurses and the patients we serve. That is the Interstate Nurse Licensure Compact, House File 462. As a leader in nursing, I feel it is of critical importance to come before you today in support of the passage of this legislation. Implementation of the Nurse Licensure Compact will address issues including the delivery of health care both physically and electronically across state lines, improve the mobility of the nursing workforce to better meet the needs of the patients wherever they may reside, and eliminate the need for nurses to obtain multiple licenses in multiple states. The mutual recognition model allows a nurse to have one license in their state of residence and to practice in other states, either physically or electronically, subject to the individual state practice laws and regulations. Children and young adults with disabilities often have highly complex medical conditions that require ongoing assessment and monitoring. One important element of the services we provide is nursing consultation by telephone. Approximately 11% of all of our patients we care for come from outside the state of Minnesota and require our ongoing care and nursing expertise after they return home. Nurses are concerned and challenged by our current licensure processes and how we can best care for these patients. We need to ensure that patients have access to the qualified nursing care at all times. Gillette experiences seasonal swings in census and acuity of their patients. And due to the specialty nature of the nursing care we provide, we often experience a shortage of experienced nurses to provide care to children with disabilities. During these times, we need to employ travel nurses to support our work, and additional time and resources are required under our current system to bring these nurses into our facility and help us meet the needs of our patients and families. The compact improves the mobility of the nurses. Communities will have improved access to licensed care providers during times of great need for nursing services. This meets the needs of the community while maintaining the high quality care needs of our patients and families. By passing the compact legislation, nurses can expeditiously respond to the community need without the constraints of being required to obtain multiple licenses across multiple states. In summary, as a registered nurse and Vice President of Patient Services at Gillette, I wish to submit support for the passage of the Interstate Nurse Licensure Compact legislation. The issues and needs of our patients and families can best be met by the compact. The patients we serve travel from across the United States, and the mobility of our patients continues to increase. These patients benefit from having access to the expertise of the Gillette nurses, who are familiar with the uniqueness of the care they need for their disabilities that pose across their lifetime. Thank you for consideration of these issues.
Thank you, Ms. Sisk. Mary Claire England, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record, the organization you represent, and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Marie Claire England. I apologize for losing my voice, so if you can't hear me, please let me know. My name is Marie Claire England. I've been a registered nurse in Minnesota for 25 years. I began my career with the Mayo Clinic. I am currently a nursing practice specialist with the Minnesota Board of Nursing, and I'm a nursing practice specialist. I also practice at Park Nicollet as a nurse providing telephone care to patients. Today I'm here to talk to you as a member of the Minnesota Nurses Association and as a nurse who supports the Nurse Licensure Compact. I am a nurse who has, for the last 8 years, provided telephone nursing care to patients. I have the experience to tell you how the compact can benefit the citizens of Minnesota, the patients we serve, and the Minnesota nurses. By law, each state sets the requirements for licensure as a registered nurse. Most states, like Minnesota, require a nurse to have a license to provide nursing advice to patients over the phone. Most states also view that the care provided occurs where the patient is, not where the patient resides, nor where the nurse is located. As a nurse, one must comply with the laws and rules governing the practice of one's profession. In my work as a triage nurse, I must consider where the patient is and whether that state requires me to be licensed in that state to provide nursing care over the phone. Patients call from out of state wanting symptoms triaged. If that state's law requires me to be licensed to provide nursing care, such as an assessment of their status and providing nursing advice, I must tell that patient to seek local care. It is frustrating to the patients, and it causes an ethical dilemma for the nurses such as me who have the skill to help the patients but are not legally authorized to do so because the patient is in another state. Continuity of care is something we can all relate to and expect from our health care providers. Some of our patients leave Minnesota for the winter months or for vacations and call back to their health care provider for a variety of reasons. To obtain refills of medications, to obtain new prescriptions, to obtain forgotten prescriptions left at home, to obtain orders for lab work and medication therapy such as Coumadin and anticoagulation therapy. Nurses need the means to provide the kind of nursing care over state borders. We need to be able to satisfy our patients' needs and keep our Minnesota healthcare businesses thriving. It is imperative to the well-being of our state. Minnesota has one of the best reputations for healthcare in the world. Nurses' concerns about their ability to advise patients because of the barriers of the current licensure system need to be addressed. Enacting this bill for the compact will move us in that direction. We are working, living, and traveling in a world of technology and immediate access. Patients need and want the ease of access to nursing care. Patients trust nurses. They want to talk to us. And they want to keep their health care in Minnesota a place they trust. We must provide nursing care within the law. Enacting the compact will help to provide rapid and easy access for our patients, and it will help me to do so within the law. I don't want to have to send my patient to the Tucson clinic to obtain care when I can provide that care over the phone and retain the revenue and patient business for my employer. Please support the Nurse Licensure Compact and the access to care for our patients. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. England. Karen McDonald. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record, the organization you represent, and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. I am Karen McDonald, and I am a registered nurse. I've been a registered nurse for over 38 years. I am representing here today the Minnesota Organization of Leaders in Nursing, also known as MOLN. MOLN is a nonprofit organization of nurse leaders throughout the state and dedicated to influencing healthcare by advancing professional nurse leadership. Thank you for the opportunity to present MOLN's position on the Nurse Licensure Compact. The MOLN Board, Executive Board of Directors, has unanimously voted to adopt a position to support the Nurse Licensure Compact. MOLN has deemed the Nurse Licensure Compact a priority issue for promoting quality health care in Minnesota and for advancing the profession of nursing. MOLN supports the compact as it addresses the needs of a mobile patient population by ensuring access to safe, qualified nursing professionals. We believe the Nurse Licensure Compact advances the profession of nursing by allowing nurses the mobility needed to care for a mobile patient population without imposing additional licensure costs. The compact does not diminish or replace labor laws, nor does it remove the state's sovereign right to regulate nursing through the Minnesota Board of Nursing. Current Minnesota statute allows nurses residing in border states the privilege of practicing in Minnesota without obtaining licensure by endorsement in Minnesota, i.e. border state recognition. This is not a reciprocal agreement and places Minnesota nurses at an unfair advantage for career opportunities in a mobile society. Minnesota border states belong to the Nurse Licensure Compact. The border state recognition law has caused confusion for nurses and employers for verification of nurse licenses. The Nurse Licensure Compact would provide clarity for nurses, patients, and employers around license requirements. The Nurse Licensure Compact also allows for an additional measure of patient security through the NURSIS system of license verification. Compact states share disciplinary information about nurses so that potentially harmful situations may be avoided proactively. The current regulatory model does not allow information other than current license verification to be shared between states. Current regulation allows for action to be taken after the event issue has occurred. We believe that the Nurse Licensure Compact is good for patients, good for nurses, and good for Minnesota business. Again, thank you for the opportunity to present MOLN's position in support of the Nurse Licensure Compact.
Thank you, Ms. McDonald. We have two testifiers who've signed up to testify against the bill, Linda Hamilton and Cindy Schoenecker. I'm sorry. Go ahead and state your name and who you represent.
I'm Lori Sisk from Sanford Canby Medical Center in Canby, Minnesota. I'm the chief nursing officer there, and I'm here today to talk about my position on the compact, that I'm in favor of the compact. I'm speaking from a Sanford health system perspective, a large integrated health system in the upper Midwest, and also as a chief nursing officer in a border state community, Canby, Minnesota. Just to talk a little bit about, I think that this compact would increase access to care and result in better care for our patients. One of the examples I think of is when we have new nurses that we're hiring that need emergency room care and obstetrics experience. This compact would allow us in Canby to send nurses to Sioux Falls, South Dakota, to our tertiary center to gain experience and work in those areas and then come back to our rural area and be able to provide care to those patients. Conversely, specialized nurses such as wound care nurses, ostomy nurses, would be able to move from Sioux Falls, South Dakota or Fargo, North Dakota, those tertiary centers into our community, into Canby, and bring that very specific nursing care to our patients. So I think it would increase access to care and specialty care with that movement of staff. It would be more cost effective by nurses not having to have multiple licenses. So much of an integrated health system has become standardized. We're on an enterprise electronic medical record. When we have purchasing that we do, we have purchase agreements. So throughout our whole system, a lot of our supplies that we use are standard. Our equipment has become standardized. If you're a nurse in our Sanford Health System, all of the equipment you use is standardized throughout our system. So this compact would allow that last component, that's the movement of staff, between the facilities. Just the other day, we were dealing with kind of a crisis in our dialysis unit. We're a small rural facility, have a dialysis unit, had a couple of nurses that were unexpectedly out. We were actually faced with the proposition of having to move patients to where there are dialysis nurses versus moving dialysis nurses to care for our patients in Canby. So I would really encourage you to pass this compact. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Ms. Sisk. Now I believe we're moving to opponents of the bill. Are there any other testifiers for the bill? Okay. Seeing none, we'll move to the testifiers against. Please state your name for the record and the organization you represent, and then proceed with your testimony. Welcome.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Linda Hamilton. I'm a registered nurse, 30 years of nursing experience, and I still work on the floor. Today I'm here, however, as in my role as president of the Minnesota Nurses Association. MNA is the largest and oldest professional union in the Midwest, with over 20,000 registered nurse members statewide. The MNA has long opposed the Interstate Nurse Licensure Compact. The compact continues to be controversial for our organization because it promotes regulatory changes that could result in real and potential risks for our patients, for nurses, and even for the state of Minnesota. Today I will be addressing many of our concerns, and joining me to address specific patient safety and nurse practice concerns is Cindy Schoniker. The Interstate Licensure of Nurses, as proposed in House File 462, is a decade-old model of licensing RNs that allows nurses licensed in one state to cross borders and practice in other compact states. Today, less than half the states have joined the compact, and many states have rejected it outright. These include Florida, Ohio, New York, Massachusetts, California, to name a few. And recently, Indiana withdrew from the compact. We continue to assert that the compact purports to fix a problem that simply does not exist. Supporters of the compact claim that nurses will move freely from state to state. However, today, with the advent of technology, a nurse can currently get a license to practice nursing in Minnesota within 24 hours or less. How much easier can it be? Additionally, it has suggested that the compact will improve access to nurses during a disaster, yet this too is allowed when a state declares an emergency. The goal of the compact is to address telenursing. Then there are measures that are far less draconian that do not negate our state's authority to regulate nurses within our border and that do not drain the state's purse. MNA does remain committed to working on issues around telehealth, but we are concerned when supporters suggest that our current regulatory system impedes continuity of care altogether. We don't believe this is true, but we do know we can do more around telehealth, but the Interstate Compact is not the answer. The real concern with the compact is that it weakens our ability of our own board of nursing to adequately regulate the practice of nursing within our borders. Additionally, it takes Minnesota's authority for oversight, evaluation, and protection of the public. We fundamentally believe that the regulation of the nurse practice and patient safety is a state's rights issue, and that is afforded to us under the constitutional 10th Amendment. The Attorney General of Kansas has found the compact to be unconstitutional. There is a reason. We also urge lawmakers to pay attention to how entry into the compact could result in a loss of revenue for Minnesota and our Board of Nursing, since nurses from other states do not pay our Minnesota licensure fees. We know that other states have witnessed the loss of revenue once they join the compact. These include Iowa and Virginia. their nursing boards had to go to their legislatures to request additional funds. Last year, during our one-day strike, over 3,400 nurses applied for temporary permits to work in our metro hospitals. Each nurse paid $115 for a license of endorsement. If Minnesota had been a compact state, this would have resulted in a loss of nearly $400,000 to our state. Finally, in 2002, M&A negotiated with hospitals to develop and enact compromise legislation to the full-blown compact known as border reciprocity. As you know, border reciprocity allows nurses working in border states to practice in Minnesota without a state license, provided they register with the Board of Nursing. The legislation also asked our board to seek reciprocity for Minnesota nurses so we could practice in our border states as well. To date, we don't know the status of this. In conclusion, M&A steadfastly opposes the undermining of Minnesota's regulatory authority and standards of nursing practice in any form. With that, I would like to turn it over to Ms. Schoniker and ask questions afterwards.
Thank you, Ms. Hamilton.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, my name is Cindy Schoniker. I work at Minnesota Nurses Association. And if it isn't clear by now, I would like to point out that we have a clear philosophical division in this room of employers and regulators and corporate interests and bedside nurses. And I really hope you consider this when you consider voting on this compact. Bedside nurses have clear and defined issues with the we think it's much more complicated than it sounds. It's not as simple as a driver's license from state to state. It's a very complex issue. If you just sit and read through this entire bill, I guarantee you're going to call Shirley up with some questions. Our biggest concern is about patient care, and we have big differences of opinion with the Board of Nursing, with managers, with other people, with corporations, that we do not believe patient care is safe under the compact. There is no evidence at all that says, that clearly defines patient care as being improved under the compact, unless it was a study done by National Council of State Boards of Nursing. Even in the one that was already brought up, the Gallup organization poll, they too said it was very undefined whether or not people really believed patient care was increased, or patient safety was increased, or if discipline of nurses really was clear and defined enough, and it was also a very confusing issue. So I want to point out that this is a very complex bill. It is not just like a driver's license. There is an independent report that was done on compact states and how easy it is for a compact nurse to take that license after being disciplined in that state to another state and work. Ms. Brecken is correct that after this report came out, there were a whole lot of nurses that were found hiding in the cracks that were addressed, but we do not know how it is working. It can only work to the best level of the state with the least restrictions. The state that is the slowest to report to the database, the state that is the slowest to finish its disciplines, it can only work as well as the slowest and worst behaved state. Under the compact, if a state licensing board does not resolve these disciplines in a timely manner and upload the information, it's lost information. It doesn't exist. Employer can't verify. No one can verify what's going on with this. Compare this to our current regulatory structure, and the Board of Nursing has to first verify the nurse's license. Is it a license in good standing? The board has to do this. The board also has the nurse fill out questions, such as, have they been fired from a nursing job? Have they had problems with the law? Do they have felonies on their record? There's a variety of questions the nurse has to fill out before she can even get a temporary license. Before the board issues a permanent license, the board has to evaluate this application and these questions, and then the board will issue the nurse a permanent license by endorsement. The compact doesn't require boards to do this, doesn't require boards to verify licenses, doesn't require boards to ask these questions and evaluate these questions. It requires the employer to do it. The employer and the nurse are the only ones that know about the verification. It does not even require the employer to report to the board if they have a verification against a nurse that requires a discipline. We believe establishing an employer-based regulatory system for a select group of nurses, of whom the legislature cannot even place additional requirements beyond those of the home state, does not provide a level of patient safety. The second concern we have is that the compact...
Ms. Schoedeker, can I get an idea of how much more you've got?
I have another page and a half.
Ms. Schoedeker, that's going to be too long. Could you maybe hit the high points?
Sure, but I think some people have talked for like 5 minutes.
No, we've allowed both of you to talk as long as the other testifiers. So
all right.
Please proceed, but if you could wrap it up in about a minute here, that would be great.
All right. We have concerns about due process of nurses. In the Gallup poll research that the board had, that the National Council had done, there was confusion about discipline in non-compact states and in compact states, and with nurse administrators of the compact states. This is a real problem because it's very poorly defined. I know there's a process, but it is poorly defined. M&A, if this is really about telehealth and telenursing, M&A has for a very long time been willing to work on that issue. We do not think the compact is the correct solution. We know that the Board of Medical Practice has a limited licensure for telehealth, where physicians have to purchase a license. It's less money, but they still have to fill out the questions and they have to follow the rules. Wisconsin has a 72-hour practice. Registered nurses and LPNs can practice in Wisconsin for 72 hours a year without getting a Wisconsin license. Those are just examples of things that we can talk about that are far less painful than throwing out the baby with the water. In conclusion, M&A leadership has deep philosophical differences of opinion with the compact supporters on a variety of other things. Clearly, I don't have time to go into this. But thanks for listening, and I think we'll be done.
Thank you, Ms. Schoedeker. Is there anybody else who wants to testify for or against this bill? I'm not seeing anybody. So, members, now we open it up to questions. First of all, Representative Norton, any responses to any comments, any additional information you want to provide before we go to questions?
Well, I think we've had plenty of testimony here, and I'd just as soon let you guys get to specific questions if you have them. I did also hear that the Red Cross is supportive of this, and it's not listed. You have a list of supporters in there, and Red Cross was not listed. I apologize for that, but they've whispered in my ear, so... told me I could share that. So if you have questions, we'll bring any of the people back to answer them.
Thank you, Representative Norton. I have Representative Barrett, Representative Quam, and Representative Loeffler. Representative Barrett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think my question here is for Ms. England. I say that because she was so informative regarding a couple questions I had that she already answered. So if she wouldn't mind coming up.
Here she comes.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Ms. England. I'm trying to understand in my mind what specific situations this compact would come into play. I know you mentioned, I think, one or two yourself, and a couple other people mentioned telemedicine, in which doesn't matter where the nurse is, it matters where the patient is. And so I'm wondering, in that situation, which law would we be breaking again? That would not be a Minnesota law if the nurse is in Minnesota. It would be, let's say they live in South Dakota. Would we be breaking a South Dakota law? I'm just trying to understand which law applies here and what extent there'd be a penalty in that situation.
Sure. Ms. England?
Mr. Chair. It's a very good question. The boards of nursing understand, at least anecdotally, that most states have a similar law to Minnesota that requires a nurse to have a license in that state to provide nursing care over the phone. So if I was talking to you and you were in North Dakota, I would need to know whether or not I need a license in North Dakota to provide that advice to you over the phone, and I would be violating North Dakota law that says that I may be practicing in their state without a license. And I'm just using that as an example. I'm not sure if North Dakota requires me to have a license. That's part of the problem. To hold 50 licenses or to find out if I need 50 licenses is a barrier to care, and our patients call us from all over the country.
Okay. Representative Barrett?
Yeah, follow up if I could. How are the different states, what are the license requirements and how different are they between the states within the compact? And where does Minnesota fall within a degree of very strict licensing and very loose licensing on that particular issue?
Ms. England?
Mr. Chair, I think that I would have to defer to Ms. Brecken to answer that question.
Sure. Yeah. Thank you.
Ms. Brecken, welcome back to the committee.
Mr. Chair, Representative, as we stated earlier, all states require that a nurse graduate from an approved school of nursing, a board-approved school of nursing, and take the same licensure examination. For the most part, states use some different ways to determine whether or not a nurse has criminal history. In Minnesota, we do it right now by self-disclosure. As Ms. Schoniker pointed out, we ask certain questions on the licensure examination, such have you ever been convicted of a felony or gross misdemeanor, those kinds of questions. We also are, this session, seeking authority to do criminal background checks with fingerprinting and FBI, which over 30 states already do in this country. So there's a variety of ways that states will approach that, either self-disclosure or actually federal criminal background checks. Those are the basic. It's really related to competence, ethical practice, and the graduation from a school.
Mr. Chair, if I could.
Representative Barrett.
And then are there any differences, large differences between the states in ongoing continuing education in regards to having a license within each of the different 20 states?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barrett. There are differences. There are states that, like Minnesota, require continuing education. I would tell you that continuing education does not assure competence. We like to believe that continuing education changes behavior and upgrades one's abilities, but the fact of the matter is, to get the hours for continuing education, you can go sit in a class and you can walk out and not have learned anything but still meet the requirement for continuing education. The vast majority of nurses don't do that. I mean, they maintain their practice, they maintain their competence through continuing education, not because it's mandated, but because they care about the kind of care they deliver to their patients. So mandatory continuing education doesn't make the difference. It's whether or not the nurse cares enough to upgrade their competence through continuing education.
Representative Barrett?
Thank you.
Very good. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think there's a major issue and minor issue in this. I think the minor issue is nurses practicing here already with the border agreement. One-sixth of the compact states nurses can practice in Minnesota. And it's been expounded upon how easily, within a day or two, a nurse can get licensed here. The issue is that with the evolving delivery of health care, is the state of Minnesota is handicapped because our nurses cannot, over the internet, over the phone, give aid. So if I'm on a trip, I can't call back from another state and get advice from my nurse that I saw, because it would be illegal for her to practice in that state. And, you know, there are many hospitals. I did a bill of where I started with 20% being outside the state of Minnesota as an exemption for the provider tax. Well, it was discovered a large quantity of hospitals in Minnesota do business at greater than 20% outside the state of Minnesota. So we are causing the hospitals to go through additional expense, hardship, be non-competitive in a national healthcare field because we don't allow them to participate in the compact. So that is the major aspect of this bill, is handicapping nurses in hospitals in Minnesota, not making it difficult for nurses to practice in Minnesota.
Okay, Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and while we heard a lot of duplicative testimony on some issues, other issues, I wish I could have gotten the other side's insights a little more further. But I am concerned. I am sympathetic to the follow-along of community of continuity of care. If someone from another state comes here to get specialty care and then calls back for advice as they're dealing with continuing issues related to recovery. And I certainly would be sympathetic to looking at that. But I have some real concerns that I kept hearing that this was about administrative burdens and rather than about patient care. And when we've entered into multi-state compacts, sometimes it's more about the administrative ease than it is about and the blending to the kind of a common understanding, rather than allowing us to be a leader. And in other areas where we've had compacts, it's actually held us back as a state in stepping forward with new innovation. And just the other day we heard a report from a commission that had worked long and hard, included lots of representatives from the medical community as well as members of this committee, dealing with the issue of Alzheimer's and how we needed to have a lot more training on that particular issue of our health professionals at a variety of different levels. And, you know, if we were to require that so that anyone who had a loved one with Alzheimer's knew that the person who was taking care of them had that training, with a compact, we may not be able to allow that. We're leading the nation in the healthcare home issue, which does change the practice of nursing. And that may change what we want in terms of the training and experience that in Minnesota to make that rollout of a nation-leading effort successful. And so I have some real hesitancy about stepping up to do this, but I'd like to understand a little bit more about the governance of the compact and how much power would we have in making those changes happen if we wanted to do something unique.
I'll let
Representative Norton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll let the Board of Nursing answer the last question, but I want to be. Well, why don't I let them answer the question first, then I will give my opinion. How would that be?
Members, I would just offer this. We need to be out of here by 4:15 for session. We have people from the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill here for a presentation, including people who have traveled some distance. I don't want to curtail legitimate debate on this bill. I think it's important, but we do have a time frame we're trying to stick to so that we can get all this in today and out of respect for the other presenters. So.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lockhart.
Ms. Brecken.
The compact provides that the compact does declare jurisdiction, how states share information, and the kind of disciplinary action that can be taken according to each individual state law. There's also a provision in the compact, which we call enabling language, that talks about how in Minnesota, and it's unique in Minnesota, how the compact interfaces with current nurse law, such as government data practices, et cetera. The provision in there for governance, as you say, is that there is an organization called the Nurse Licensure Compact Administrators, and that group is comprised of the executive director of each board of nursing that is in the compact. The purpose of that compact administrators group is to assure that all of the states are complying with the law, with the compact. How they share information, how disciplinary action is taken, whether or not a license is in the state of the home of the nurse versus having one in any compact state. So that's the purpose of that compact administrators group, is to assure that compliance is equal among the states. So from a governance standpoint, the governance is that the law as it is enacted by the legislature in each state.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Norton.
And I would just say to some of the other issues that Representative Loeffler raised, and certainly some of the nurses too, there is the state law, there is the training and the education, but there's also a responsibility of the people that hire these nurses to provide that level of oversight. And that's what our hospitals and our providers do. So the nurses all come to us qualified. They've all taken the same exam. They've all graduated from a qualified school. The employer can require continuing education if they so choose, because they'll know that they're hiring a compact nurse. And then it's up to that employer to make certain that the rest of it is, that the nurses are providing to the level that they expect. And that's true now.
Representative Loeffler?
Well, I think that it sounds to me like the compact is focused primarily on the functions of a licensing agency, which is dealing with minimal entry level requirements for getting into a field and how to handle discipline. and I didn't hear a way in which we would address what I think are the more important policy issues related to what are minimum training expectations that we expect of the state in order to implement the health reforms we're pursuing. And so with that, I will just say that's my continuing concern.
Okay, thank you, Representative Loeffler. Representative Fritz, and then I have Representative Benson and Representative Murphy. Representative Fritz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And first, I'd just like to make the comment that there were six people who did testify before. Ms. Cindy Schoenecker, I believe, was the last person who I felt that I didn't get to finish or hear the finish product of her testimony and would have liked to. And I've heard this. Both sides of it, but it's a compelling piece of legislation for me in that I have, you know, and still do have maintained my licensed practical nurse. I continue to do that for the past 40 years. And I did hear some good things coming from that testifier, so I hope that we can connect again here while we're talking. But I do have my main questions are for the Board of Nursing. And what I'd like to know is how much is a registered nurse's license, a yearly license?
Ms. Bakken.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fritz, initial licensure is $105 for both registered and practical nurses. The license is renewed every 2 years, and the renewal fee is $85 for 2 years.
Representative Fritz.
And I have a follow-up. And on that, with the CEUs, which I do every year, to me, or every time that I re-up, I take my CEUs, and I do take them serious. And this is the word that I really want to bring forth with this particular group of people, that nursing is a very hands-on, very, very intense profession. And this is something that should be not taken lightly or licensed lightly or be talked to, as I heard one of the testifiers say, rapid and easy. Those are not words I've ever used in my nursing career. Nothing is rapid and easy in this very serious profession. And I think that when you did say that we take our CEUs and you can take them or leave them is kind of what I got from you. And I really think that that's unfair in to those of us. And we did have a discussion in my office the other day as well. I could not, after being here 7 years and I continue to maintain my license just in case, I do not think I could go back to work and do the work of the LPN today, because in 7 years the technology has changed, the improvements are there, and it's evolved, but I keep it. And I would definitely have to go back and take some further education. But in my career, I have had nurses come to me who did not take very good classes. And just one little instance is when I remember an RN coming to work with us, and she did not know what acetaminophen was. I said, Tylenol. So, you can forget and not, it's a learning process, continual learning process. And so this is a very serious issue. It's a very serious business, nursing and hands-on nursing. I just wanted to make that point. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Fritz. Ms. Brecken.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fritz, I did not in any way mean to minimize the value of continuing education. What I did say is that I believe the vast majority of nurses do continuing education because they care about providing competent nursing care. They don't do it because it's required to renew your license. I really believe they do it for the right reason, not for the legal reason per se. There are many states that have greater continuing education requirements than Minnesota has. There are states that require nurses to actually be in practice. Actually, our neighboring state of North Dakota requires that you practice 600 hours within a two-year period in order to renew your license. If you are not doing that, you cannot renew your license. So clearly, there are differences between what states require for, and that's why states are working towards standardization. It's called the Uniform Licensure Requirements, and there are real efforts to make that standard or uniform across the country.
Members, we need to move to a vote on this in the next several minutes. I don't want to curtail legitimate debate, but let's a couple more questions and hopefully we can go to a vote. Representative Benson, Representative Murphy, and then I have Representative Huntley.
simple yes or no for either Representative Norton or one of the testifiers. If a nurse should give advice to a patient who's now out of state, is there exposure to litigation to both the nurse and the provider, medical provider?
Ms. Brecken.
That depends. and I think it's both a yes and a no. It truly depends upon whether or not the nurse does so knowingly, or whether or not the state actually has the requirement that the nurse be licensed in that state to provide that advice, and then, quite frankly, whether somebody finds out about it. So that's the yes or no, I guess.
So possibly?
Possibly. Yeah.
Very good. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a few questions, and I'll speak fast so we can adhere to your schedule. First of all, in response to Representative Norton's the roles, there is the role of the registered nurse to assure she's providing safe care, and that's the first and foremost safeguard. There's the role of the Board of Nursing, which is to assure public safety and making sure people are licensed. And there is a role for the employer dealing with hiring and employment policy. But they're not, and they should not have the role of assuring public safety. That should rely, that should rest with the public board, the board that we have charged with assuring that the nurses are licensed properly and adhering to those standards. So I think that part's very important. Ms. Brecken, a question for you. And this ties into what Representative Loeffler had suggested, but I'm curious to know, as we look at the legislation, where are the bounds, or are there boundaries at which our ability to amend the legislation create problems in terms of the work of the compact?
As I understand it, and
Representative Norton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The compact language itself is not amendable. The language of the compact.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so I think Ms. Brecken wants to answer the question as well. So
Ms. Brecken.
There would be language that we would have to pass in law.
Mr. Chair and Representative Murphy, Representative Norton is correct that that section in the bill that includes the compact language needs to be adopted the same in every state. And in fact, that's why Indiana did not, it wasn't Indiana withdrawing from the compact. Mm-hmm. Indiana could not be a part of the compact because they changed the language when they passed the bill. The second part of the bill, the second section of the bill, really deals with how the compact interfaces with current Minnesota law, such as Administrative Procedures Act or labor law or any of those things.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, a question I think for Ms. Brecken. If a nurse, and forgive me, I always mess up the home state, party state, but if a nurse who is licensed in Tennessee, for instance, so we enter the compact and her license is recognized, so practices here and harms a patient, and the patient seeks redress against that license, where will the patient act to achieve that?
Ms. Brecken.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, the patient would seek redress with the board in which the state in which it occurs. So if it's a Tennessee nurse working in Minnesota on the Tennessee license, the patient complains to or issues the report to the Minnesota Board of Nursing, who conducts the investigation. But that state may do so in cooperation with the state of Tennessee or any other state in the compact where the nurse may or may not have practiced or may have practiced. And they're able to share, the states are able to share the investigative data, which we are not able to do now.
And Mr. Chair and Ms. Brecken,
Representative Murphy.
How do we... And I understand the role of the board is to protect consumers. But how, as we are sharing data about nurses who may be accused but haven't been convicted, how do we assure their due process rights when we establish a national database, a database?
Ms. Brecken.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, again, the state, Minnesota has the obligation to follow the due process rights that are provided by Minnesota law. The one difference is that exchange of information, that ability between the states to be able to exchange the investigative data as it's occurring. And an example of that might be that that nurse may be licensed in Tennessee and may have practiced in Minnesota and may have practiced in North Dakota, you know, other compact states, that remote state, and had similar problems. That investigative data then is available to each of the states instead of waiting until one state takes action and then the next state takes action and the next state takes action.
So, Mr. Chair and Ms. Brecken, then, is it possible?
Representative Murphy, quickly, please.
Nurse, I'm trying to go fast. That a nurse could be accused of something in a state and not hired in another state because the information's been transferred.
Ms. Brecken.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, I hope I'm understanding your question. I think what you were asking me is, so if that information is available to the compact states and that nurse then applies to another compact state, another remote state for employment, that information isn't available to the employer. I mean, so the hiring, you know, is done by the employer. The information is available to the boards only who are conducting the investigation.
Representative Murphy?
Mr. Chair, I just have one question for Ms. Schoniker, please.
Mr. Chair, Representative.
Thank you, Ms. Schoniker. In your testimony,
Representative Murphy,
you talked briefly about a shifting role, or your concerns about a shifting role from an obligation that belongs to the Board of Nursing and going to the employer. Could you just elaborate on that a little bit more? I didn't understand what you were talking about.
In a compact state,
Ms. Schoniker, briefly, please.
Sorry. In a compact state, the Board of Nursing does not verify the license as they do currently in Minnesota. In a compact state, it's the obligation of the employer to verify the license. The employer is not obligated to report any findings to the Board of Nursing or even to report that the nurse is here. Did I answer your question?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you. Just one last question, Ms. Schoniker. When you were offering your testimony earlier, were there other points that you were unable to make because of the time constraint? Or were you able to complete your testimony?
No.
Ms. Schoniker.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, there was more.
Mr. Chair and Ms. Schoniker, I would like to request your testimony in writing for the entire committee.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Huntley.
Well, Mr. Chair and members, this is going to be the second toughest vote of my life. Both involve changes, big changes. In the mid-'80s, I was on the Port Authority in Duluth, and the Longshoremen's Union thought they could operate like they did in the 50s. That was a very tough vote for me, and this is another tough one, but it's about adapting to the way the world is changing, and we can't hold back. It's kind of funny that earlier this week we heard from a physician that did not want to adapt to the changes in the world. He wanted to practice medicine like he did, learned it when he was in medical school. The world changes. All of the healthcare reform things we've done in this state, healthcare homes, chronic disease management, the big winners are going to be nurses and nurse practitioners. They're going to be in huge demand. They're going to be the ones that do the chronic disease management, and they should be charging into the future. If you look at Mayo Clinic, they're deeply into Wisconsin and Iowa. If you look in my part of the state, St. Mary's Duluth Clinic goes from Wisconsin to Utah, and the hospital in Superior is maybe 5 miles from the hospital in Duluth. If you look at Health Partners, they talked about they're heavy into Wisconsin. If you look at the western part of our state, and I'm going to be in Bemidji tomorrow talking to the Sanford people, North, South Dakota, and western Minnesota are all run by the Sanford system. We need to adapt our rules and allow us to change the way we need to go, and I think this is a good, positive change for Minnesota.
Thank you. Members see no other questions. Representative Quam.
I would like to request a roll call.
Roll call has been requested. If there's no other debate, Representative Norton renews her motion that House File 462 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. The clerk will take the roll on the bill.
Gottwald?
Yes.
Mack?
Yes.
Abler?
No.
Barrett?
Yes.
Benson?
Yes.
Franzen?
Yes.
Britz?
No.
Grunhagen?
Yes.
Hosh?
No.
Huntley?
Yes.
Giffmeyer?
Yes.
Liebling?
Yes.
Loeffler?
No.
Lohmer?
Yes.
McDonald?
Yes.
McElpatrick?
Yes.
Moran?
Yes.
Murphy?
Not yet.
Yes.
That's a no.
That's
Norton?
No.
Yes.
Peterson?
No.
Quam?
Yes.
There being 15 ayes and 6 nays, House File 462 is, the motion prevails. House File 62 is passed and re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. Thank you, Representative Norton.
Thank you, members. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Ms. Abderholden, my apologies. We don't have a lot of time. I think we're going to try to prioritize people who have come from the furthest away. Your message is very important for us to hear, so welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Sue Abderholden. I'm Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota, and I'm representing the Mental Health Legislative Network, a coalition of over 20 organizations dedicated to improving the mental health system. And we thank you for the opportunity today to talk about some of the significant reforms that have taken place in the past 5 years. And I do have packets for you. In 2003, a broad coalition of public and private organizations undertook an effort at reforming Minnesota's mental health system. It was called the Minnesota Mental Health Action Group, MHAG, co-chaired by the then Commissioner of Human Services, Kevin Goodnow, and the chair of the Citizens League Board, Gary Cunningham. And it was made up of representatives from a wide range of organizations, including state agencies, advocacy organizations, hospitals, community mental health providers, health plans, counties, psychiatrists, the University of Minnesota, and others. Prior to MHAG, there had been countless reports that cited poor coordination, perverse financial incentives, underutilization of evidence-based practices, and ineffective early intervention as fundamental barriers to delivering good and timely mental health services. The mission that we adopted was that Minnesota embraces a vision of a comprehensive mental health system that is accessible and responsive to consumers, guided by clear goals and outcomes, and grounded in public-private partnerships. We received a solid endorsement in April of 2005 when Governor Pawlenty issued a directive to DHS to design a mental health system in Minnesota, both programs and funding, that was consistent with MHAG's vision, principles, and outcomes. In 2006, a few items of the governor's mental health initiative were passed, but it wasn't until 2007 that the full initiative passed. There were three key items. One was the infrastructure investments, such as crisis services, school-linked mental health, supportive housing, and evidence-based practices and respite care. And an important piece of this, I want to say, included collecting outcome data, which we couldn't have obtained if we had simply block-granted the monies to counties. Second was the adoption of the model benefits set under Medical Assistance, Minnesota Care, and then General Assistance Medical Care, which provided a clinical foundation for transforming the system, which includes treatment and services that are effective for individuals, such as ACT teams and the like, which you'll hear about. And third was the PIN projects, Preferred Integrated Networks, which were to look at how to integrate physical and mental health care services within prepaid health plans and how to coordinate prepaid health plans with county services. At this point, I'd like to turn it over to our next testifier.
Thank you, Ms. Abderholden. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and what organization you represent, and give us your testimony.
My name is Tracy Newman, and I'm here with the organization of NAMI. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I just want to share briefly my personal story and the benefits of the services that Ms. Aberdeen spoke about. I have a son living with mental illness, and his diagnosis is bipolar, manic depression, and schizophrenia, psychosis. He's a very generous and kind-hearted young man, and he enjoys helping other people. He attempted suicide because he felt hopeless in being able to fulfill his dreams and live successfully in society. He lost his hope of going to college, getting a job, and living a successful life. He couldn't see a future. But after his hospitalization, we utilized the services that were offered through residential treatment programs, the crisis service centers, case managers, and ARMS, which is the Adult Rehabilitation Mental Health Services. These services are invaluable to my family. Now that we have the support of the services, life for him and me is becoming more manageable. He plans to attend the community college to become a barber, and he now has hope and sees a future for him living successfully within society. I fear that without the mental health services and resources, that I would lose my son forever. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you for your testimony.
Please state your name. My name is Maureen King.
Welcome, Maureen.
I'm an adult who has struggled with mental illness issues since 1979. I was in and out of treatment centers through those years, both in North Dakota and Minnesota. I'm a college graduate. I have been a resident of Minnesota since 1992. Adult Rehabilitative Mental Health Services of Minnesota has kept me out of the hospital, saving taxpayer dollars. One specific instance was my grandfather's death. Normally, any family death would have sent me to the hospital with mental health issues spiraling out of control. At the time of my grandfather's death, the service was readily available for me. Service has kept me stable for years. I have not been hospitalized since 2004. I'm a productive member of my community. I'm employed by a mental health center. Also, I'm the president of National Alliance on Mental Illness West Central Affiliate Chapter. The National Alliance on Mental Illness increases the understanding of mental illness and assists people with mental health issues through advocacy. I am a taxpayer. Adult Rehabilitative Mental Health Services has helped me and others remain stable over many years. This is an invaluable service for those of us individuals with mental health issues. This service helps me remain in the community as an active functioning member in and out of the hospital. Thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you for your testimony.
Mr. Chairman and committee.
Welcome to the committee.
My name is Gail Howman, and I'm a certified peer specialist with Northland Counseling in Itasca County. Our mission statement is recovery is knowing who you are and using your strengths to be who you were meant to be. We are Medicaid billable and funded under Adult Rehabilitative Mental Health Services. I'm here today to tell you about what I do. I share hope and encouragement with my peers through helping and caring because I have been there with my own mental illness. We discover coping skills together so they can have the life they want, not the life it is necessarily right now when other services may not have worked. One of my peers has always hung his head and kept to himself. Now he holds his head high and is a perfect gentleman because that is who he really is. He's found his competitive spirit again and his desire to be a part of the world. I have also worked with someone everyone else has given up on because all he talked about and talked to were the voices only he could hear. But now he laughs, makes jokes, and thanks me profusely because he can get out in the world and feel alive again. I have been asked what my mental illness is because my peers are starting to feel like there may be hope after all. They want what I have. Imagine what hope is inspired to see what is possible in front of yourself and be able to say, if she can do it, so can I. My life has a fabulous purpose now. I work very hard at using the coping and helping skills I learned in my consumer survivor network training, because I know I am setting an example of a life worth living and hope. When I went to training, it brought up a lot of issues I had not yet resolved that kept me from living fully and out of depression. It was very healing to my soul and help me open up to be the best peer specialist I could be to help others find their way to recovery. We need peer specialists because we understand better than anyone else what having a mental illness is all about, and can share and hope and experience on how to avoid hospitalizations and how to stay out of expensive services, because we have the skills and confidence to do so. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Hellman. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, committee, good afternoon. My name is Dawn Graham. I am a certified peer specialist with Northland Counseling in Itasca County. As a certified peer specialist, I use my experiences with mental illness and recovery to assist others with their mental illness in their journey of recovery. In the past, the treatment for mental illness has been to maintain stability with the symptoms of our illness. Now, with the Certified Peer Specialist Program, the goals of people with mental illness are recovery, to have happy, productive lives, and live to the fullest potential. This program, as Gail said, is funded by Medicaid. I have already seen how well this program works. One of my peers I work with is achieving one of her long-term goals of going to college. As her peer specialist, I give her encouragement and support to reach her dream and to better herself and have the career that she wants. I also have not one of my peers have been rehospitalized over this winter. This program will make a meaningful difference in the lives of those affected by mental illness. They will finally have hope and motivation to have the lives that they dream of having. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Graham. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. My name is Tom Belcher. I'm with Greater Minnesota Family Services. I'll try to abbreviate my comments, as I've been asked to cover both Children's Therapeutic Services and Supports and the infrastructure grants for the schooling mental health. I'll try to compress them and make the best use of the time that's available.
You're getting members. We are going to go to 4:20 to give you a little extra time.
Okay. We've been providing in-home counseling services for the past 15 years. Greater Minnesota provides services in 34 counties in the southwest corner of Minnesota. Our services are funded predominantly by medical assistance and insurance reimbursements for psychotherapy and skills training, with approximately 30% of our agency's reimbursement for these services coming from counties for uninsured clients and adjunct services. We meet with clients under 21 with a diagnosed mental illness for approximately 3 to 9 months in order to assist them in regaining age-appropriate functioning. Commonly, it's to assist children deal with disruptive behavior, depression, trauma, or anxiety. Many of the families we serve would not be willing or able to receive mental health services in another setting. Since 2007, many of our clinicians have attended evidence-based practices training, and we're incorporating these techniques into our treatment. We've also started to reach out to younger and younger children. We're now partnering with more and more Head Start agencies to provide a specialized mental health care to young children in order to intervene as early as possible. One outcome I'd like to share with you quickly: we provide reports regularly to our partner counties. Last year in 2010, we served 1,018 clients. Of that number, 404 of those children were at risk of out-of-home placement, and 287 we prevented from placement. That resulted in a net savings of almost $2 million to taxpayers in various counties and to the state of Minnesota. I'll skip ahead to the school-linked mental health services that we're also providing. We've been providing these with the assistance of state grants since 2008. We're providing services in 19 schools in New Ulm, St. Cloud, Redwood, Cottonwood, Lyon Counties, McLeod County, and Morrison County. Funding for this program comes from infrastructure grants, medical assistance, private insurance, and county collaboratives. School-based services provide a therapist or mental health practitioner in school buildings to provide the same type of rehabilitative services that Children's Therapeutic Services and Supports typically provides. One of the most important pieces of this program for its efficacy is the fact that it sees all students regardless of their insurance status. Nearly 50% of these children who are receiving services have never had a mental health service before. I just wanted to quote quickly one of our direct services provider, as she has a very on-the-ground kind of understanding of what's going on. I think of SchoolLink Mental Health as one of the first entry points for children who need mental health treatment. A child displays either emotional or behavioral issues at school. A teacher makes a referral and the child receives the necessary help. We do the initial assessment and determine a diagnosis and make recommendations. For most of the families we deal with, if the child didn't make that referral to us, this child would likely continue to flounder. Behavior comments would be made to the parents at conferences or the parents would receive a call from a principal if the behaviors were disruptive enough. Outpatient counseling would be recommended and the family would have to figure out how to get their child to weekly appointments 20 to 30 minutes away. It likely wouldn't happen and the child will suffer. SchoolLink Mental Health is convenient, thorough, and effective. The Children's Mental Health Division's provided a lot of outcome data for this, but one of the last pieces I wanted to share with you is we provide two counselors to an alternative school in New Ulm, Minnesota. Students at an alternative level, at an alternative learning center have already been identified as being below grade level or pregnant, a parent, chemically dependent, an abuse victim, or having mental health needs. So that's the population that we're serving. Just wanted to share with you, in the last 3 years, we've increased the graduation rate of that alternative learning center in New Ulm by 20%. 20% more kids are graduating because of these grants, and I wanted to thank the legislature for this funding and encourage you to continue to fund these programs so that families can live in their, so families can work, they'll be good functioning in school, and children will be graduating in order to become contributing citizens. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Belcher. Welcome to the committee.
Hi. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify. My name is Jim Reby, and I represent Central Minnesota Mental Health Center, and I'm a working supervisor for those folks, and we serve the counties of Benton, Stern, Sherbert, and Wright. I'm going to share just a little bit about Assertive Community Treatment Act. And I was going to talk a little bit about adult rehabilitative mental health services, but I think the peer specialist said it all about that program. So I'll try to shorten my comments. Funding for these programs are medical assistance, Minnesota Care, as well as county and state funds. Assertive Community Treatment is a team treatment approach designed to provide comprehensive community-based psychiatric treatment, rehabilitation, and support to persons with serious and persistent mental illness, such as schizophrenia. A team of professionals whose background training includes social work, rehabilitation, counseling, nursing, and psychiatry provide assertive community treatment. Among the services that ACT teams provide are case management, initial and ongoing assessments, psychiatric services, employment, housing, family supports, education, substance abuse services, and other services and supports critical to an individual's ability to live successfully in the community. ACT services are available 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. Some say we are a psychiatric hospital without walls, and there's not many places where physicians make house calls, but this is one program that it does. Members of the committee, I hope you had an opportunity to review the information that has been provided to you. The charts and graphs that was provided by the Department of Human Services demonstrate positive outcomes for community mental health treatments. This information clearly shows the cost savings of the assertive community treatment and adult mental health rehabilitative service programs. It is also significant to note that the number of hospital bed days used by people dropped by 70% in 2009 upon receiving ACT services. If you put this decrease in bed days to money, a potential savings was had by $15 to $37 million. For armed services, hospital bed days dropped by 45% upon receiving services, and that amounted to a savings between $8 and $22 million. I'd like to share a true story how perseverance and dedicated staff can make a difference. It was about 5:30 p.m. one day, one fall day, when a woman entered the ACT office to find her clinical director at her desk. The woman was desperate to find help for her son, who we can call Bill. Bill, a former college student, had been in and out of the hospital for mental health issues. Bill had quit taking his meds and was refusing treatment. Bill had been to the emergency room several times, and he had run-ins with the law and had been incarcerated for a time. Bill was severely ill and was experiencing many psychiatric symptoms. Bill's mother felt she had nowhere to turn. Our ACT team repeatedly tried to contact Bill. At times we were successful if his mother was at home. However, on numerous occasions we would visit only to have Bill run and hide or refuse to come to the door. At one point he even hid from the team members and his family for hours in the woods, and law enforcement needed to be called. After much time of trying to engage Bill and develop that trust in order to provide services, our team was finally successful. Today, Bill is a success story. He is taking his medication, moved into his own apartment, and is attending vocational school. The ACT team continues to monitor and assist Bill in his recovery. I believe the services I have described are life-changing for not only the consumers, but also their families and friends. These services restore consumers' dignity, improve their quality of life, and gives them the opportunity to be a real part of the community. If one of my or your family members should ever need mental health services, I hope and pray ACT and Armed Services are an available option. It truly makes a difference. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Reby, and thanks for your service to Central Minnesota. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. I'm Mark Bronson. I'm the clinical director at Zumbro Valley Mental Health Center.
And I'm Judy Eichmann, the chemical health and homeless services team director at Zumbro Valley.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Zumbro Valley Mental Health Center provides services in Olmsted and Fillmore counties. We also provide services to residents in Winona, Houston, Maurer, Dodge, Steele, Waseca, Blue Earth, Rice, Kutu, and Wabasha counties. Our mission statement is that Zumbro Valley Mental Health Center is your primary community partner for responsive, effective, and affordable mental health and chemical health care. We're here to talk to you today about our integrated dual disorder treatment program. Funding for this program is a combination of medical assistance dollars, Medicare dollars, private insurance, self-pay, and the consolidated chemical dependency treatment funding. The description of our program is that Zumbro Valley Mental Health Center began its efforts to provide an enhanced treatment for people with co-occurring disorders in 2007 through a grant from the Minnesota Department of Human Services to develop a work plan to implement treatment for clients in our mental health center and in our mental health and chemical dependency programs. Since that time, we have developed successful services to address the unique needs of this population, including training staff on principles of co-occurring disorders, implementing assessments, screening tools, holding team-based meetings to collaborate on treatment, supporting a dual recovery anonymous group on-site, and offering a group for clients and their families. In November 2009, our organization also received a dual diagnosis enhanced recognition from the state. A team-based approach is our core philosophy for integrated dual disorder treatment. Working together with psychiatrists, chemical dependency counselors, therapists, probation officers, and primary care physicians can better treat the whole person by coordinating care. Other benefits include decreased length of treatment time because mental health and chemical dependency issues are being addressed simultaneously. A focus on treatment through outpatient programs instead of more expensive inpatient options, improved quality of care, and fewer detox admissions and incarcerations. The treatment for co-occurring disorders utilize multiple best clinic practices, including motivational interviewing, case coordination with other professionals, including families and other supports in the recovery plan. Our case study demonstrates how these practices work effectively.
A good example of the IDDT, or Integrated Dual Disorder Treatment, is a client whom we'll call John today. At the time John began services, he had been struggling with chemical dependency for years, including a relapse to alcohol that resulted in serious legal charges,
placement on probation for 10 years and a mandate to receive treatment. His substance abuse diagnoses were alcohol and amphetamine dependence, and his mental health diagnoses are bipolar disorder, PTSD, and dissociative identity disorder. One of the recommendations from the initial substance use evaluation for him was to participate in an outpatient co-occurring disorder treatment program. Although John had prior substance use treatment, this was the first time that he had participated in a co-occurring disorder program. He learned early on that his mental health symptoms had triggered alcohol, drug, and vice versa, helping him better understand his situation. He immediately requested to work with a psychiatrist as well as a therapist. John has followed through with his legal obligations, and all drug screens since began working with Zumbro Valley Mental Health Center have been negative. He is also working with his physician to address his physical condition. Through his treatment, John reached out to his teenage daughter, who lives in another state with his ex-wife. He recently arranged for his daughter and he to visit his parents. This was the first time in 12 years that they had visited his parents together. This client case attests to outpatient-based treatment for co-occurring disorders as an effective, affordable method of care. The average estimated cost to treat a client is about 25% of what inpatient care costs. As a community mental health center that serves thousands of clients each year, this provides state and federal payers an effective option for people with co-occurring disorders. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you for your testimony. We have about 3 minutes remaining. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Glenn Anderson. I'm Executive Director of Northern Pines Mental Health Center, which serves Aitkin, Cass, Crow Wing, Todd Morrison, and Wandena counties in central Minnesota. And I'm here to talk to you about our mobile crisis outreach program. And I know I don't have very much time, so I want to make my point at the beginning. It's not enough in these times for a program merely to be really nice and good and effective. It also has to save money. And so if you look at the handouts that are in your packet, the last chart shows how of all of the suicidal call-outs that we went out on in 2010 to emergency departments in our region, we kept three-fourths of them out of the hospital. And the savings to the system was more than three times the cost of the entire program. So having made my point, I'll describe you how this works. We have a team that provides coverage 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. On every call out, we send a mental health professional who is licensed and capable of actually acting on the spot, calling for a transportation hold if necessary, delivering services, lining up services. We have rapid access to psychiatry within 72 hours, although in truth it's always available within 48 hours. We arrange for next day appointments. We transport people. We serve law enforcement community, the jails, the schools, the emergency departments, and our promise to all of those providers who are faced with somebody shows up at their door in a mental health crisis, if they call us, we will come with no questions asked within a half an hour. And so far we've been able to average that over the years that we've been providing service. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I'm Jill Wiedemann West. I'm representing People Incorporated. We are an agency that provides community-based mental health services to Hennepin, Ramsey, Dakota, Anoka, and Washington counties. We have 41 programs, and about 5,500 clients are served a year. My intention is to talk to you just very briefly about crisis services. You have in your packet some information about residential crisis services. Residential crisis services is a service level that provides care for individuals in psychiatric crisis that do not choose to or do not need to be in a hospitalized setting. This service If you look at the information that you have, served through People Incorporated last year, the services of residential crisis residences served 2,600 individuals just through People Incorporated crisis programs and 3,471 statewide. If you look at the one of the second pages in your packet of material, you can see a little bit about how the difference of just 3 to maybe 4 days of residential crisis services can impact positively an outcome for an individual in crisis without needing to be hospitalized. And on the final page, there is a comparative for you that talks a little bit about the differential in the cost of hospitalization to a residential crisis setting, which hopefully provides for you a pretty clear picture of what an extraordinary cost savings it is, as well as a truly innovative and good way to care for these clients. I tried to be very brief.
Thank you for your testimony. Mm-hmm. I apologize for the shortness of the time. Welcome to the committee.
Thanks. Thank you. My name is David Shuckman. I've been a clinical social worker in Minnesota for 33 years, and I've been specializing in working with immigrants and refugees for about 18. I'm currently the director of immigrant and refugee behavioral health at Volunteers of America Minnesota Mental Health Clinics. I run a program that provides mental health services to Somali youth and families. The short version of what I want to say is that we were able to start that program with a grant from the Department of Human Services infrastructure grant, and it allowed us to start the program. We've provided, in the 2.5 years of the program, we provided services to 141 Somali youth and their families. And the other part of it is that we've been able to enhance the capacity of Somalis to become and advance as mental health professionals and practitioners. We were able to work with 10 Somalis in that amount of time. And I'd like to introduce my ex-colleague, Dega Ali, who was part of that.
Hi, good afternoon.
Welcome to the committee.
My name is Dega Ali, and I had the opportunity to work with David Shukman as an internship. I'm a student at St. Kate's, majoring in social work. David worked with, like he said before, he worked a lot of Somali immigrants, especially youth who are caught up in between two cultures. And we know in the Somali culture, we really don't talk a lot about mental health as the American does. And it's really very hard, people who are working, especially with the Somali community. And I really do appreciate what David does for the Somali community. Without this funding, it wouldn't really be impossible to help a lot of youth off the street who are mentally ill or who are in trouble at home. So I really appreciate it. Thank you for your time.
Thanks to all of you. I know there were a few others who were on the list, and I apologize. We've run out of time. But Ms. Abderholden and all of you from NAMI, thank you so much for being here and sharing this information. And we may have some additional opportunities to get an update on the results of all these wonderful reforms. This is a reform committee, and what you've done is saving money and saving lives. So we appreciate what you do. Thank you. Members, that is it. No other business before us. The meeting is adjourned.